Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today George Vesey. He's written a biography of Stan Musial, Stan the Man. It's An American Life. Welcome to the program.
My pleasure. Always nice talking to you all.
George, I have been an admirer of yours for many years. I've been reading the New York Times for many years, and you are one of my favorite writers over there because you have written so widely about my favorite sport of baseball. So when I saw that you'd written a book about Stan Musial, I said, wow, we get to talk about baseball, and I get to talk to George.
Oh, aren't you nice? Thanks.
How long have you been writing for the Times? About 50 years?
I've been working for 50 years. I went over from Newsday,
okay.
the great paper that it once was, in 1968. So I've been with the Times since 68. But I actually covered my first game in 1960 when I was just about out of Hofstra College.
And you've covered a lot of beats, haven't you?
Done all kinds of. I was a baseball writer in the 60s, and I sort of identify with that. I mean, a grunt going from game to game, that's my roots. But I went on to do like a lot of Olympic stuff and the World Cup. I've covered 8 straight World Cups of soccer, which has become my second love. And, you know, lots of other things, tennis and Tour de France. I mean, I love the international sports.
And you've written a pile of books. And
that's a nice way to describe it.
I have interviewed a lot of Times writers because Times writers are a lot like college professors. You put out a lot of books. It's publish or perish, huh?
Well, given the salaries, you sort of put 3 kids through school by writing books in spare time. They weren't going to go to private schools on private colleges on New York Times salary.
You've also apparently got a very strong interest in mountain music.
Oddly enough, yeah, I was a national correspondent for the New York Times back in the early 70s. I lived in Louisville, Kentucky. That seemed to be like a regional. So I covered the region. I would get up into Ohio a lot and mostly into the mountains by choice because I was just taken by the coal mining and all of that and got to know Loretta Lynn and got to be a country music buff in that brief slice of time.
Stan Musial, I'm guessing this one's been on the back burner for a while and you decided it was finally time to do it.
Well, it stems to my tortured childhood when every October the New York Yankees would beat up on my Brooklyn Dodgers. But during the season, this guy would come to town 22 games. He'd play 11 at the Polo Grounds and 11 at Ebbets Field and just beat the brains out of the two New York teams. And that was Stan Musial. And he would do it with a smile on his face. Hit a double, hit second base, come up smiling. And the amazing thing was, and believe me, I'm bold enough to say that, those were nicer times. People were nicer back then, and even in Brooklyn, which had a reputation as a hard town. But Musial was the visiting player that New York adored. In fact, that's where he got his nickname of Stan the Man. You know, fans just saying, here comes the man again. And somebody heard it and picked it up, and the St. Louis writers started calling him Stan the Man.
I did not know anything about his background until I read your book, and I was amazed to discover how many well-known baseball players have roots in this little town in Pennsylvania.
Well, if you just want to count Musial and the Griffies, Stan Musial played on his high school team, Denora High School, with Buddy Griffey, the father of Ken and grandfather of Junior. And when Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues in 1947, while Musial was hardly an activist or a speechmaker, you know, he's exactly the opposite. But people would say to him, you know, how do you feel about Robinson? And Musial would say, I played with those guys in high school. They were my teammates. And they had a history. They had once walked out of a hotel in, I want to say, Pittsburgh during a state basketball tournament because the hotel was messing around with, you know, hiding them from, you know, from view and all that. And they just walked out and went to another hotel. So that's where Musial got his very quiet, unspoken sense of fairness that he lived up to in 1947.
George Vesey joins us. He's written Stan Musial, An American Life. Recently, I had the opportunity to interview Jimmy Breslin for his Branch Rickey biography. And reading through that, obviously it was a short biography. But I don't remember any mention of Stan Musial in that book because obviously it's about Jackie Robinson primarily.
Right.
But Branch Rickey was a key figure in Musial's background, too.
He was, in the sense that he ran that farm system, which just signed up all these poor kids. And in those days, under Rickey, it was all poor white kids. And they just signed everybody that needed a dollar to their name and would go off and play somewhere. And Musial was one of those guys. They sent him to West Virginia for a few years and then somewhere else. And he was having moderate success as a wild left-handed pitcher. And it wasn't until he had a tremendous spring in Columbus, in Springfield, Missouri, that Rickey showed up. And ever after, Rickey could tell the story, and I've seen it on tape, of Rickey giving an interview in the early 60s before he passed, of Rickey saying, well, we had our eye on the boy, and we knew, and I went. And it is true, he did go down to Springfield to scout Musial. But in reality, there were so many other people who were the offshoots of Rickey. In other words, Rickey had all these scouts and managers out there, so it was his system. But he wasn't exactly the fairy godfather of Stan Musial.
It's hard to imagine Stan Musial in any other uniform besides the St. Louis Cardinal uniform. But early on, before he really became a Cardinal, he had a little bit of doubt about being with that team, didn't he?
Well, right. He had heard the Cardinals had been penalized for signing a bunch of players illegally and signing up. They would sign up entire leagues sometimes. Rickey was a pretty devious guy for all his Bible spouting, and he would sign up things he weren't supposed to do. So the commissioner of baseball, who couldn't stand him, Commissioner Landis, he went after Rickey and let loose a lot of players, including a very good St. Louis boy named Pete Reiser, who wound up with the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Musial heard about this, and I guess he was having second thoughts. And then a friend of his in this little mill town in western Pennsylvania took him up to what might have been his first or second visit to Forbes Field in Pittsburgh, and Musial got the bug of playing with his hometown team. And he made, well, I can't say it was a mistake, he was honest, he told somebody, I think it was Pye Traynor, the coach of the Pirates. He said, you know, I have actually signed a contract with the Cardinals. And Traynor at that point turned to him and said, you know, Branch Rickey never lets anybody get away. You know, son, you're going to get called to the Cardinal farm system, which is what happened a few weeks later. But, yes, he did have second thoughts. And in fact, even when he first broke in, there were talk that first started to have success, that the Yankees were looking at him and the Giants and, you know, teams that had a little bit of money were looking at him, but by that time, Rickey would not let him get away.
You take us back to 1941, the year that Pearl Harbor was bombed, and that we have these great players who have their careers disrupted by wartime service. You've got Joe DiMaggio with the Yankees. You've got right. Ted Williams with the Red Sox. And then you've got this little rookie in St. Louis. And he was the quiet one, wasn't he?
He certainly was, and it was his personality. He had trained himself to be not particularly noticeable. He was uncomfortable speaking in public, and he was a little bit shy and bashful in his own way. Although certainly a fine fellow and a great teammate, people loved him. But he managed to get it into baseball, to stay into baseball while DiMaggio and Williams were going off to war. The only year that he was away was 1945, and there are reasons for it. He was a sole support of his parents. His father was ill by then, and he and his wife had married young and had two children by that point. And so he was the sole support of a family. I'm sorry, he had one child. So he was the sole support of a family. And he didn't enlist, but that area had so many men going into the service from those mill towns that the draft board had no problem at all with deferring somebody with an ill family.
And Stan Musial originally thought he was going to be a pitcher, didn't he?
He was. He thought he was a hitter. He couldn't understand why they signed him as a pitcher. I mean, he was a pretty good pitcher as a kid. He won a lot of games in high school. But he was not a phenom either, and he was pretty wild. One scout or manager wrote a report in this very well-organized farm system of Rickey, and the report said, this is the most puzzling, wildest pitcher I've ever seen. And, you know, for a grunt lifetime manager, that was quite a statement. But Musial's record was, you know, lots of walks. And then he hurt his arm. He was playing the outfield because he could hit. the manager in Daytona Beach, Florida, used him in the outfield, and Musial was making a diving catch in the outfield and hurt his shoulder. And pretty much then he knew that he was not the same pitcher, that he never was going to make it, and that the Cardinals didn't bring him in for arm surgery the way you would nowadays with a prospect. So by the end of his third year, he pretty much knew that he was going to have to make it as a hitter.
And Stan Musial went on to be one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, but he wasn't in a big media center, was he?
Well, you know, St. Louis was certainly bigger in those days. It was a top 10 city in population in when he came up in 1944, in that decade, and it has been sliding ever since. I mean, right out of the top 50 or 60, I mean, all the Sun Belt and so on. But St. Louis was the gateway, and it was a big-time city in a lot of ways that people paid attention to. It wasn't the media city that New York was, but on the other hand, there was pretty much only New York and Chicago, and the West Coast wasn't even that big in those days if you looked at it, and there wasn't all the internet and the television and so on. So St. Louis was proportionally a lot more important, and people in St. Louis, and I have to say this, I love the city, I've been going there for a long, long time. They have worked up this feeling that Musial was ignored because he was a God-fearing Midwesterner and people in the East don't like that kind of guy. Musial was a prince in New York. He came to New York as a visiting player. He was royalty. Dodger fans loved him. I mean, I don't say they cheered every hit he got, but they loved him. And when he was staying in New York, he knew the restaurants. He and Red Shandings would go out at night. They'd go to a Broadway play. They knew actors. They hung out in places. I mean, they were hardly bumpkins. And he was lionized in New York. So it wasn't that Musial suffered because, in fact, there were two or three papers in St. Louis in those days, and he certainly was lionized there. But in New York, the columnists, the big-time columnists, the Joe Williams, the Red Smiths, the Arthur Dailies, they wrote about Jimmy Cannon. They wrote about him all the time. They'd go to spring training, and, Williams would cuss at them, and DiMaggio would sulk. And there was nice guy Stan Musial, and he'd sit, and in his own, not particularly eloquent way, he would chat. And let me tell you, as I've come to realize as a sports columnist, we're pretty easy. We're pretty charmed by somebody that'll sit there and say, "Hey, fellas, how you doing?" and talk to you for half an hour and give you your column so you can go to the pool.
And then you had Ted Williams, who loved the press.
Well, yeah, the knights of the keyboard. I mean, Williams was a grump in those days. I got to see him when he was an older man, and he was pretty charismatic. I mean, the guy that I saw as a manager in the 60s and then as an icon in later years, I mean, he was pretty charismatic guy. It was a pleasure to be around. He had all kinds of theories, and I interviewed him a month or six before he died, and it was pretty sad to see. But he was a different person. I mean, back then he was a tormented soul. The interesting thing that I bring out in the book, and I guess I'd never realized it so much, was all three of them, the what I call the big three, had ethnic drive and background. Williams, which I'd never realized, and nobody ever made anything of this, his mother was Mexican.
Uh-huh.
Mexican background.
Uh-huh.
And not only was she a Salvation Army lady out all day, saving souls in San Diego, but she had a Mexican background. And I think that led to Williams being a pretty fair man, particularly toward the Negro League players when they got into baseball. I mean, he was certainly more liberal than the team he played for in that sense. DiMaggio came, his family was from Sicily, they were fishermen. He had a pretty strong sense of distrust of management and leadership, as well he should have since the Yankee management tried to exploit him and used the New York press to call him unpatriotic and selfish and all of this. And then there was Musial, coming from a Polish father and a mother of, sort of Hungarian/Czech background, and hearing Polish spoken in the household, and all these other ethnic groups in Donora, Pennsylvania. All three of them came from a very strongly ethnic point of view. The book, the subtitle of it is Stan Musial, An American Life, A-N, American Life, and it's a very apt subtitle that somebody else came up for me, and it really tells the story, that this is a kid that saw deprivation, saw his father marching downhill every day to work in these pretty horrendous steel and zinc mills, coming back, sort of beat up by the process. I got taken around Donora by an old pal of Musial's, a man about 80 named Bimbo Ciccone, who played tailback for Pitt and, you know, was an icon at Pittsburgh. And Bimbo was talking about working in the summer in the steel mills. You know, he's young enough and sharp enough to remember what it was like to work in the steel mills, and that's what Musial faced if he couldn't hit.
He was the one who remembered Stan's dad walking down the street tossing a baseball up in the air.
Right. That's very true. The father, as an immigrant, did not have much feel for baseball. There's a whole story, you know, you can hear different layers of it, but the essentially the father did not want the boy to sign a baseball contract. He didn't understand it. The story that's been told by the family is that the father wanted the son to go to college. Other people say, no, the father wanted him to work in the steel mill. Mm-hmm. So in between, Musial wound up getting his way because the mother stood up for him, and I guess he did himself. But the father came to appreciate baseball when the son made it to the major leagues, and in 1942, the father and mother were brought to New York for the World Series, games 3, 4, and 5 against the Yankees. And at that point, the father thought it was pretty cool, and you can certainly see it from his point of view, you know, coming from Poland and not understanding the culture and being very much an outsider, you know, a greenhorn in the classic American sense. All of a sudden, people are fussing over him because he's the father of the St. Louis Cardinals' great young hitter.
George Vesey joins us. His book is Stan Musial, An American Life. And we're losing them one by one, some more quickly than others. Stan Musial is still with us. In the book, you describe how he shows up at Mickey Mantle's funeral, and you bring out the zinc link, which I found to be fascinating.
Oh, right. That Musial, of course, had grown up, his father had grown up in the mill, and the Donora smog, the infamous Donora smog, which I find that people of next generations don't know about, was this killer smog that settled over the Monongahela Valley back in Halloween of 1948 and killed a lot of people and really hastened the end of Musial's father. And then Mantle had grown up in the zinc fields of Oklahoma, and there was so much cancer and other illnesses that ran through his family and his wife's family, just people who had worked out in that environment where the slag heaps were left, all this garbage is left behind by American industry, happened to get into the lungs and bloodstreams of people who lived there. So Mantle grew up with that, and I'd never linked it as zinc until I read my pal Jane Levy's wonderful book on Mantle, where she went to the hometown and got taken around to all these slag, these heaps of refuse that were killing people, still can continue to do that. A little left behind product of American industry that they leave behind for the people that live there.
Mm. I grew up in Des Moines, and our Little League Park was named after the heater from Van Meter, Bob
right.
Feller.
And
I loved your story about the barnstorming tours that he organized that Musial was involved in, and how Feller was so fair about paying guys the same amount of money, whether they're black or white, and how Musial was making some pretty good money on these barnstorming tours compared to what he was making with the Cardinals.
Yeah, Rapid Robert had two planes, one for the white players and one for the black. Not that he segregated them. They were two different teams, so he flew them on different planes. But they were exactly the same planes, and they were exactly the same paycheck, you know, or bills that he handed out. And even though Feller got a bad rap because he had said that he didn't think that he didn't think that Jackie Robinson would be a good major league player, well, neither did Musial. They saw Robinson's rather muscular batting stance, and they didn't think he'd be able to get around on pitches. Well, he was. Baseball was his fourth best sport. On the other hand, Feller did run a very fair barnstorming at a point when black players were just about coming into the major leagues. He was already ahead of them in that he traveled with them.
And we lost another great, Bob Feller,
who
passed away here recently. Stan Musial's still alive. You talk at the end of the book about a surprise encounter with him.
Exactly. I knew that he was not going to be available to me for a couple of reasons. One, he had cut off interviews many years before. He wasn't happy with some of the detailed, very, very private person, and he just wasn't giving interviews. And his family has pretty much been that way, except for a few that, you know, felt more comfortable talking to me. But I was told I wouldn't be able to meet him, and that was fine. I'd been around him when he was finishing up with the Cardinals back in '62. Casey Stengel would take us out to his restaurant in St. Louis and all of that. But it happened that I was taken out to lunch by a very good friend of Musial's, a former chief of detectives named Jim Hackett, and we're sitting in this place, the Missouri Athletic Club, out in the county, and he's telling us this is the table where Stan sits when he goes out to lunch. And all of a sudden, Stan's grandson wheels Musial, by now in a wheelchair, into the restaurant, and they're going into the back into another table. But I just laughed and I said, "You set that up." And my friend, the detective, laughed and said, "No, you know, Stan goes out to lunch with his grandson." And as they went by, I was introduced to Musial and I got to shake hands with him. So it is a sort of a coda to the book that, after being told that I wouldn't, that at least to see him. Obviously, you know, it wasn't for the book, and I wasn't about to say to him, you know, "Mr. Musial, I'm working on your book," or anything like that. But it was just seeing this tired fellow, you know, whatever he was, 88 or 89 at the time, seeing him going out to the back of a restaurant, and it's a memory. It's just being up close to him.
I love the photos in the book where he's showing his swing, and you've got the pictures of the statues of him, and the one he likes a lot better than the other. You tell us why, because the one isn't the right. It's not the right pose.
Yeah, you know, it's art, and as the husband of an artist, I take that artists do things their own way, their own vision of things. So this sculptor came up with a rather large, you know, I think about 200% size of a human figure, and it's like one of those old Soviet sculptures, you know, the strength of the proletariat. And it's not exactly the batting stance or even the body type of Stan Musial. You know, it's a rather thicker person sort of wielding a mace. And people in St. Louis, you know, they didn't get it and they didn't like it, and Musial didn't get it and didn't like it. But it's become sort of an, you know, it's you go to that ballpark, and you as a Midwesterner would know that you go to Sportsman's Park, and of course now it's the third rendition of it, of Busch Stadium, and you meet by the statue of Musial. Well, I was out there for a weekend 2 years ago. I was working on the book, and young lady in Cub outfit, they were playing the Cubs, and she comes by and she says, "I'm supposed to meet my boyfriend by the statue of Musial." And I said, "Well, no, it's the one down the block. It's the big one." The one that she was standing by was the two-thirds lifestyle by another artist named sculptor named Weber, who got much more energy and action into 10 great St. Louis players. It's a beautiful, I liken it to the Xi'an warriors, the terracotta statues found in China. Oh. And you have these 10 St. Louis greats. Two of them were not Cardinals, as a matter of fact, but just this St. Louis outdoor sculpture garden hall of fame of Enos Slaughter sliding with his spikes up, and Gibson letting fling, probably pitching one into somebody's ribs. And there's Musial with this great finish of his batting swing. And Musial liked that one much better.
George Vesey joins us. His book is Stan Musial, An American Life. I have only one Stan Musial story. But back in the early 80s, I was helping someone in Des Moines out with an estate sale, and they had all these toys and boxes full of junk, and I was rooting around in there, and I found a baseball that was all grass-stained, but I noticed it had signatures on it, and it had a lot of signatures.
Mm.
And I looked closely, and here was Stan Musial and Red Shane Deist and Peanuts Lowry and Enos Slaughter, all these names. And then there were some names I didn't recognize, so I went back and I got my baseball encyclopedia, and I looked them up, and there was one guy on there who had come up for 1 week, had a cup of coffee, in August of 1953, I don't remember the guy's name, but I could pin down this was a team ball signed in this week of August, the year that August Busch bought the team.
Right.
And I held on to the ball, and then I was leaving town about a dozen years later, and I was having an auction of household goods, and I thought, you know, I'd really like to get some people to come to my auction, so I advertised the team baseball, 1953 Cardinals. This old guy showed up, and he says, you know, he says, "I was the team trainer for the Iowa Oaks." And he had come to buy the ball on behalf of the Iowa Oaks shortstop at the time, a guy named Tony La Russa.
Wow.
He bought the ball for Tony La Russa, who then auctioned it off for some charity he has for abused animals.
That's funny. funny.
So that's my Stan Musial story.
That's a good story. La Russa could have, and the funny thing is, La Russa, of course, has wound up working for so many years in the town that honors Musial. La Russa could afford it. I think he got a pretty nice bonus from the Charlie Finley's A's. He wasn't any good, never played much, but I think that he probably had a few dollars even as a minor leaguer. But it's interesting that he is a college man and smart, maybe a little bit more outgoing than the average player would send the trainer down for that. Mm. That's a cool story.
Yeah, well, I just had to share because that's my only Musial musing.
I will ask La Russa about it at some point.
Yeah, George Vesey has been our guest. His book is Stan Musial, An American Life. Let's talk about the hitting. What was it about Stan Musial and his hitting? I mean, what was so good about him?
Well, hand-to-eye coordination, and he was a great athlete. I mean, he was a basketball player in high school, and he always said he would have liked to have been a boxer, and the football coach was trying to get him to play quarterback, and he wouldn't play. But he was a great athlete with great hand and very strong back muscles. He was a whippet, a thin, wiry kid, didn't eat a lot when he was a young man, but he certainly was anybody could see in the, sixth grade, 10th grade, that Stanley was the best athlete in town. So you had that. And then he worked himself into a batting stance when he got into the minor leagues of trying to make contact. He was not a power hitter, didn't think of himself as one. So he got himself into a crouch and really almost defensively trying to make contact with the ball, and because he was such a great athlete, he could make contact and put the ball pretty much where it was pitched. If it was in the outside, he was quick enough to get around on it in double-A ball, triple-A ball, and then finally he got to the major leagues, and he continued to get better. Because of the stance, people were thrown off a little bit. He sort of turned himself around, his right hip facing the pitcher. He's sort of a peekaboo stance, looking over his right shoulder. And so they thought that this was sort of a convoluted stance. But I have talked to some of the old contemporaries of Musial, great old guys that I know, like Don Newcomb and Ralph Kiner. And both of them say, well, that's a total fraud. For anybody to get caught up in the fact that Musial was uncomfortable or in some kind of locked stance, Newcomb said, you take a look at him, before I'm letting loose the ball, Stanley is opening up his hips, he's moving forward to be in a position to hit, and by the time the ball is coming to the plate, he is in full swing, and Musial, Newcomb says, that the guy wore him out over the years. And of course, then Nuke adds, you just ask him who won those games, which the Cardinals don't like to, nobody likes to remember that, because the Dodgers dominated as soon as Newcomb and all the other guys arrived. But even Ricky, they all said, don't pay attention to the way he's standing before. That's just his way of getting into his swinging position. Pay attention to what he's doing as the ball is coming to the plate. And then you see a great athlete opening up with his hips unlocked and meeting the ball and putting it where it deserves to be put.
Well, it's really been great talking baseball with you, George.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you very much, man. I appreciate your great questions.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Tune in next week for a provocative interview with Chris Hedges. His new collection of essays is called The World As It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress in The Book Nook. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.